So how does your day begin? Do you need just a little kickstart to be propelled into your day? If so, you're far from alone. Lots and lots and lots of people need a drug to get going and keep up the momentum. It's okay. The drug is completely socially acceptable because it's caffeine. Today's guest, Murray Carpenter, looked into the science and sociology of our most ubiquitous drug in his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us, now out in paperback. Murray Carpenter holds degrees in psychology and environmental studies and has had his work published in a number of well-known media outlets. That includes reporting caffeine-related stories in Wired, The New York Times, and on NPR. Caffeinated first came out in hardcover last year. Now it's out in paperback, released by Plume Books. Murray Carpenter, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Your introduction is called A Bitter White Powder, which, of course, you know, brings up thoughts of cocaine first off. But so what is caffeine?
Well, it's just that. It is a bitter white powder, and it's sort of, I guess when you see it in its raw form, it does remind you of cocaine. But that, you know, we don't usually see it in its refined state. We mostly experience it in coffee or tea, and really it's a naturally occurring chemical compound that occurs worldwide in plants where its primary function seems to be as an insecticide.
Really? So it keeps the bugs off plants that have caffeine within them?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, and so it occurs naturally in, you know, in Central America and South America, in cacao, the plant from which we get chocolate, in coffee, where it originated in Africa, and in tea, of course, in Asia, and other plants as well.
And as you point out, the effects of caffeine can be quite pronounced. How little does it take to stimulate us?
Well, surprisingly little, and I think this was one of the big surprises for me when I was researching the book, is that some people are quite sensitive to caffeine and can detect, you know, as little as, 5 or 6 milligrams. This would be like less than a sip of coffee. But most of us, if you give us either a placebo or, you know, a beverage with a little bit of caffeine, could probably detect at 20 milligrams, which is about half the amount in a can of Coke or, you know, really the amount in an ounce of coffee.
Really? And so I mean, you mentioned it was like 1/64th of a teaspoon or something like that is what the general dosage is?
Yeah, 1/64th of a teaspoon if you're looking at this pure powdered form of caffeine. And I should mention, yeah, in its pure form, it's really quite powerful. So if you have refined pure caffeine, 1/64th of a teaspoon would be the amount in a can of Coke. 1/16th of a teaspoon, again, a very small amount, would be about the amount in a strong, say, 10 or 12-ounce cup of coffee. And a heaping tablespoon would reliably kill an adult. So it's a drug that's more powerful, I think, than most of us recognize. And the reason, of course, is that most of us don't consume it in its pure powdered form.
Wow, it can actually kill, though, huh?
Absolutely. In fact, tragically, since I published the book, there were 2 deaths in this country of people who, unintentional overdoses of people who were trying to mix their own sort of energy drinks and overdosed and died. One in a young man, a prom king, 2 weeks away from graduation in Ohio last May, and another young man in Georgia last June or possibly July.
So were they mixing their own pure caffeine into something?
Exactly. They were mixing their own pure caffeine, and this has actually become a bit of an issue because you can buy pure caffeine online, you know, no questions asked, no age limit, and it's quite cheap. So, you know, I have a 100-gram bag of caffeine that I bought online for about $10, and that's 10 lethal doses right there. So the parents of these children who or people, young men who died, have been working with some senators to try to get some regulations, try to get FDA to regulate caffeine powder itself in its pure form. You know, of course, this is extreme. Most of us don't use caffeine in this form, but I think it's interesting because, you know, this pure form of caffeine does illustrate that, you know, it is a drug and it can be a powerful drug.
Well, you quickly assure us in the book that you are one of the many addicts. I mean, how long addicted, and what's your usual CDM, caffeine delivery method?
Yeah, so I've got a cup of coffee here in my hand. I'm a coffee drinker from way back. I've been drinking coffee daily for, you know, about 30 years. And I'm a moderate to high coffee drinker, so about 300 to 400 milligrams a day, which would be, the equivalent of, say, 24 ounces of good, strong coffee.
Was there a turning point, Murray, in your own use of caffeine that spurred your research?
There wasn't. It came about incrementally. When I was in college, I was what the caffeine researchers would call caffeine naive. I was not, you know, a coffee drinker. It wasn't part of my life. But between where I lived off campus and the campus, there was this great little coffee shop, and my friends and I used to go and hang out there on our way to school. And because I was caffeine naive, I noticed more strongly than most people, you know, I had no tolerance, that a couple of cups of coffee would really help me to focus for studying. And so that got me interested in caffeine. I was a psychology major. I ended up doing a senior paper about caffeine and cognition. And so it's been a topic that I've been interested in for a long time.
But it sounds like you might not have partaken of coffee, at least at that point in your life, if you hadn't been hanging around with these friends who hung around at the coffee shop. It's a social thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a social thing. And that is one of the interesting things about coffee is, you know, it's both, right? I mean, we definitely like the drug caffeine, but we also like the social aspect of taking a coffee break. And, you know, interestingly, I think the two are related in another way, is that caffeine, you know, one of the effects caffeine has on us is it does make us more sociable. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a social aspect to caffeine consumption.
Murray Carpenter from 2015, talking about the widely used, abused, and yet accepted drug of choice for many Americans. His book is Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Murray Carpenter's got so much more to talk about. You'll hear it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Murray Carpenter, journalist with degrees in psychology and environmental studies, turned his focus on himself and people like him a few years ago. What are we putting in our bodies with that morning cup of coffee or two? He put the answers in the book Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. We go back to 2015 now with the usual reminder, callers did join us the first time around, but we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Murray, there's a phrase in here, well, a couple of phrases, I guess, to really inspire caution, but one of them is when you describe an industry running wild. How is the industry running wild?
Well, in this way, I mean, the Food and Drug Administration really has a very hands-off approach to caffeine in one sense. They for example, energy drinks, which came on the market, you know, in a big way in the past 10 years. Have never been assessed by the Food and Drug Administration for safety. And they didn't come to the agency, they didn't come to FDA for pre-market approval. The whole industry sort of emerged organically. Red Bull sort of introduced itself, you know, it had been marketed in Europe and introduced itself into the market in California. And nobody said anything, and then they sort of expanded nationwide, and then the imitators and successors like Monster and Rockstar just figured, well, hey, you know, we could do this too. And so, you know, it's remarkable to me that a whole sector worth billions of dollars of the beverage industry has not been fully assessed by FDA, and you know, in fact, they don't even have a definition, a regulatory definition, for what an energy drink is. You know, put another way, there's no limit to how much caffeine you can put in an energy drink. Now, FDA makes it clear that they could, if they wanted to, if they chose, if they felt an energy drink was unsafe, they could request that it be pulled off the shelves. But, you know, so far, they really do not have a regulatory regime for energy drinks. So that's one way in which the industry is running wild.
We've already established the dangers of caffeine, that, yes, too much of it can kill you. And you cited the two cases of people who died after you were done writing the book originally. There is, it sounds like, a real narrow zone, though, between, hey, I feel good, and, hey, I feel jangled and worse.
You're right. I mean, it's actually, this is one of the ways in which it's actually what I would consider a good drug, because the zone is not as narrow as you think. So there are drugs, for example, heroin, where there is a really kind of a narrow window between, hey, I feel good, and you know, then being actually unresponsive and dead. With caffeine, there is a fairly wide range of unpleasantness between sort of the optimal dose and the lethal dose. So, you know, for most of us, we've had the experience, maybe you had one too many cups of coffee and you sort of feel jittery and maybe anxious. There's quite a big area, you know, in there. So for me, you know, if I had maybe a half of a teaspoon, for example, of pure caffeine powder, I'd be jittery, I'd be anxious, but I wouldn't be dead. And so, you know, fortunately, there is quite, it's actually quite difficult to overdose. You have to take the pure form of caffeine, and you have to take a fair amount of it.
Is it just that it gets so diluted by everything else? You'd have to drink, like, what, 50 cups of coffee or something to knock yourself?
Yeah, it would probably be 50 cups of coffee, or, you know, 50 energy drinks, or 200 cups of tea. It would be pretty challenging.
I didn't ask why you, I mean, I'm sure for scientific interest and all that sort of thing, for journalistic integrity to be able to say, look, here's the white powder. But have you done anything with the caffeine powder you have?
Absolutely not. No, I'm not scared of it. It just doesn't necessarily intrigue me to blend it. I mean, you'd have to be careful measuring it, you know, for example. It's a small enough amount that you really would have to be careful measuring it. Now, I have sampled, you know, I have dozens and dozens of what I call caffeine delivery mechanisms, and I've sampled a great number of them, from energy shots to caffeinated gum to the energy gels that the athletes use to, sort of concentrate, the Kraft cells that you're supposed to blend into water to make your own energy drink. So I have experimented quite a bit.
Mary Carpenter is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Not surprisingly, a few calls waiting to talk about caffeine. Here's Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thank you. I had the opportunity when I was in college, my first year, taking a prerequisite chemistry class, and the teacher actually was doing a very socially conscious service to all of us young students by putting a molecule on the board each morning and having us go through what it takes the body to break it down. And he did drugs like LSD, and one day it was caffeine. So what I learned then was that it takes 4 days for the body to break down caffeine. And so we actually always have some that our body is working on and expending energy to, you know, release from the body. And so I can see how, for focus, caffeine is good, and I do drink coffee. But, you know, for the energy thing, it's an illusion because it's taking more energy to break that molecule down.
Okay, interesting input there. Thanks for that, Julie. Appreciate it. Murray, anything you've heard about that before?
Well, that would be a bit longer than my understanding is for breaking it down. Typically, the half-life of caffeine, and this is going to vary from person to person, but typically it's 4 to 6 hours. So, you know, most of it will be out of your system, you know, in, say, 6 hours. You know, you can still detect effects 12 to, you know, 16 hours later from a strong caffeine dose, but I'm not convinced it's going to be in the body that long. But, you know, there are some interesting points there. I mean, you know, people are concerned about whether, you know, what the net benefit of caffeine consumption is in terms of, you know, so-called energy.
Well, we have talked about anecdotally about some of the things, you know, the fact that you said it made you feel better focused in college. So what did you find out scientifically about neurological effects and the actual things it does to us, for us?
Well, I mean, caffeine's primary mechanism is pretty basic. It looks enough like a neurotransmitter called adenosine that it's able to sit in the adenosine receptor and basically block adenosine's function in the brain. And adenosine, in short, would tell the brain when we're tired. So that primary mechanism has a lot of ramifications. It can manifest itself as making you can experience this as feeling more alert, more focused, even more sociable, and slightly have a slightly elevated mood. This is the same mechanism even that they can help athletes, because it can help athletes from perceiving exhaustion. So it's interesting. It's kind of a basic neurological effect that has a lot of that we experience sort of broadly.
All right. We're talking to Brent Murray Carpenter about his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Brian in Roseburg, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Thank you. Beautiful day here. As you alluded to at the beginning of this segment, caffeine is one of the more socially acceptable drugs, but it seems to share a lot of the same issues with many other drugs. Kind of uncomfortable to say that we enjoy getting together to have coffee, but it's a little less palatable to consider a drug den of, people gathered together. But there's a social aspect to all the drugs, and as well, for example, we're putting caffeine in foods, as he described, and we're putting other drugs in foods. Edibles are one of the issues with the marijuana situation. And I'm just wondering what you think about is caffeine sort of leading the way in the discussion of how to use drugs in a positive way, or is it kind of lagging behind? What are your views on how we're dealing with those issues?
All right. Thanks for that, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and the drugginess of caffeine, I think, is something we're uncomfortable with, and this is part of the reason I'm intrigued by the white powder. So, for example, if you're at work and your coworker says, "Hey, I'm going out to the coffee shop to get a cup of coffee. I'm a little tired." You might say, "Hey, will you grab me one?" But if your coworker, whips out a bag of caffeine powder and measures off a 16th of a teaspoon and laps it up, you would think, "Hey, you've got a drug problem." So I do think in this way, it's a good drug to help us understand, to help us talk about other drugs, drugs of abuse or otherwise, because it's even sometimes considered an addictive drug. For most of us, I think we've made the calculation that the benefits of caffeine outweigh the costs. But it's still worth talking about as a drug that can be abused, and clearly, although it has some benefits, it has some costs as well. I hope I'm answering your question. I guess my point is I do think it's worth discussing as a drug, and I do think as a society we are moving forward in terms of not just saying, and I think this is what you're getting to with marijuana, not just saying, some drugs are good and some drugs are bad, but saying, what drugs are appropriate at what time and at what doses and in what context.
Because we don't tend to think in terms of alcohol as a drug either, and yet it's the same sort of thing. It does alter our consciousness, but that, like caffeine, is totally socially acceptable.
It's a great analogy. Yes, right. We don't tend to think of it as a drug, and yet it is, and many of us use it daily.
Another call here from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Murray Carpenter, the author of Caffeinated.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Mr. Carpenter. An anecdote here. I normally have a cup of very weak coffee. I take a full scoop and a scoop, and I put it in a 4-cup Mr. Coffee filter drip maker, which turns out to be very weak coffee. But I have it with my morning tobacco cigarette, and I got the caffeine situation. It didn't run in my family, but when I started working at my workplace, they always had this workplace at 25 cents a cup machine that you would put things into, and that's how I got interested in it. And Mr. Carpenter, I would just want to ask you something about, does your book cover anything like exotic coffees? And I don't mean like the Vietnamese glut that we had on the coffee market a couple of years ago. I mean exotic coffees like that pass from the digestive system of civet cats and elephants and whatnot.
Oh, Kopi Luwak, yeah.
Yeah, something of that nature. And And Jeffrey, I'll take his response off the telephone.
All right. Thanks for that, Jamie. Appreciate it. Yes, you did do quite a bit of research, both historical and geographical. But did you get the Kopi Luwak?
That's something that I did not. I came very close. I was talking to a barista in New Orleans, and he made me an espresso, and then he went behind the counter, and he pulled out this bag of that coffee, and a friend of his had been stationed in the Air Force in Indonesia and had just gotten him this bag of coffee. And I thought, oh, well, this is finally going to be my chance to try this special coffee. And he told me he was saving it for a meeting of baristas later that week. So I didn't get a chance to try it, but it sounds interesting.
So actually what happens is that in this case, the civet cat, which I guess is not quite like our domestic cats, but about the same general size, eats the coffee beans off the tree, and then the poop is collected, and you know, they take the beans out of there and then roast them. Is that the basic idea?
That's the basic idea. I even saw that they're doing this same thing with elephants recently. So, you know, I think in both these cases, the primary aspect is the novelty.
Does it do anything to the caffeine content? Does it affect that level of architecture?
My guess is no.
I don't know. It still cracks me up. I've been hearing about this for years and don't know anybody yet who's done it. Now, you did, again, travel lots of places to get a real handle on caffeine through history and through the world. And your history lesson begins with chocolate in Mexico. And how big a source of caffeine back when it was first being used by humans now and then?
Yeah, so chocolate is the caffeinated product for which we have the earliest documented human use. So 3,500 years ago in what's now the border of Mexico and Guatemala on the Pacific coast, people were drinking frothy chocolate drinks. So using the cacao seed and mashing it up and having a strong drink, and it would have been caffeinated because, of course, chocolate has caffeine. And so, yeah, chocolate was a big source of caffeine, and even during the Spanish conquest, it became popular in Europe. It sort of got, I think, pushed aside as a source of caffeine by coffee, in which the caffeine is more concentrated. And one of the funny things that's happened, or I don't know, funny or tragic, with chocolate, certainly in the U.S., is that we're consuming chocolate, or until recently we have been, in such a dilute form, you know, in commercial-grade milk chocolate bars, that you really don't have much caffeine content at all. So this is changing a little bit now when you have the really rich sort of chocolate bars that have 50 or 60 or 70% cacao, and those are a significant source of caffeine.
So generally the darker the chocolate, the greater the amount of caffeine?
That's right, yeah.
And so you had some interesting servings of a beverage in that region of Mexico where chocolate was first consumed. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they still consume chocolate. There's some local recipes that are very similar to the form that they were consuming chocolate in years ago. And these are blends of corn and cacao, and now they're also blending in sugar, which wasn't originally part of the recipe, as I understand it.
Quite bitter, the way it was served by the ancients, wasn't it?
Yeah, it probably was. Pozole is one, and Tascalate is another, and they're really... One of the reasons that they're different than the way we experience chocolate is because it's the whole cacao bean that's mashed up into this beverage. So it's really, you know, it's got a lot of chocolate. It's got a lot of, I guess what you would call mouthfeel. It's got all the cacao, the cocoa butter still in it. And so they're really quite delicious.
Let's take another call. Here's Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Murray Carpenter, the author of Caffeinated.
Hi, good morning to both of you. I wanted to mention a book that sort of combines the history of civilization and beverages. It's called The History of Civilization in Six Glasses. And it goes over six different beverages. For a long time, mankind could not drink water because water, when you got concentrated large numbers of people, they got sick. They got dysentery. So the Romans and the Greeks, for instance, introduced wine, which would keep, and they added to water so you could drink the water, and even babies drank it. And then you go on to Middle Ages in Europe, and you have beer, which sort of accompanied, you know, medieval times and development of, you know, Romanticism. And then The British came up with tea, and tea was compared to beer and wine more sobering, more rational. And they developed tea houses where people discussed things and brought up rationalization. And then coffee supplanted tea, and that was accompanied the age of invention, the age of electricity, the age of industrialization. It kind of made everyone more energized. Then after World War II, we had the age of Coca-Cola, which sort of saw mass production, mm-hmm. The introduction of the internet, globalization, franchises, junk food, overall a frenzy. And now we're back into people are overweight and obese, and the new hot beverage he was arguing is water. So
interesting.
We all circled the globe, and every civilization and era or an epoch kind of had a beverage that kind of drove that civilization.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate it. Murray, did you run across that book in your travels?
I did, yeah, by Tom Standage. Very interesting book. One of the interesting things, as your caller points out, is that several of the beverages were caffeinated, right up to and including Coca-Cola.
Murray Carpenter from 2015 talking about his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. You've got time to grab another cup of coffee with this break coming up. You'll hear the rest of the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Coffee, tea, cola. We have many ways of getting caffeine into our bodies, and we frequently do just that. Journalist Murray Carpenter explored the phenomenon in his book, Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. You'll hear some calls in here, but the interview was from 3 years ago, so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Another call here from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Murray Carpenter.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I just have questions about consumption of caffeine. My interest is the ability to drink coffee all day long. I think particularly in some of the older generation than myself, which is considerable older, where they had a mild coffee and they drank it 2, 3, 4, 5 cups a day, but had no trouble going to sleep, and they'd done this for decades. And then, as you mentioned, some people can have a sensitivity that, you know, they just have a few sips of tea and boom. And I think also on the flip side, the cultures in the Middle East and in Asia, where you have tremendous amounts of tea drunk all day long again. So is there a genetic basis to sensitivity to caffeine, or is there also the adaption of the body to ingesting large amounts of caffeine through the mild caffeine through the day?
Thanks for those questions, Connie.
Thank you.
Yeah, those are two very interesting aspects of this. So the answer to your question is yes and yes. There is a genetic aspect to how we metabolize caffeine, and it can vary dramatically from person to person. I'm sure we all have met people who say, yeah, I can drink coffee up until the moment, you know, I go to sleep and sleep like a baby, whereas others of us have to stop at 2 in the afternoon, and other people, you know, really a cup of coffee in the morning will keep them up. So there is a wide range from person to person, and then there is on top of that the issue of tolerance. We pretty quickly develop what's a partial tolerance to caffeine. So if you're a habitual caffeine user, the cup of coffee or tea that you have today will not affect you as strongly as the first cup you ever had. One of the interesting things about tolerance is you can reset your tolerance pretty much to zero within a week or two. So if you go cold turkey, or if you, fade off and decide to stop with caffeine, you can get back to the point where you redevelop whatever caffeine sensitivity you originally had. But particularly in the area of genetics, researchers are learning a lot more about how caffeine affects people, and really the degree to which it is influenced by our genes and by specific what they call SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, the actual just differences in our genes that affect the way we metabolize caffeine. So I think both of those things are really interesting.
Connie gave us some good context there that also appears in the book and about how our grandparents could seem to drink coffee all day and then sleep just fine at night. And you point out there has been a shift down the generations in how we consume caffeine. I was a little surprised about this. We've shifted away from coffee, you're saying?
We have, and this surprised me greatly. Our grandparents drank not just more coffee than we do today, but twice as much coffee. And this astonished me. It's something people in the coffee industry know quite well. And again, I mean per capita. So what happened is coffee consumption in this country peaked somewhere shortly after World War II and then started a gradual decline. This decline is mirrored by an increase in the consumption of soft drinks, Coca-Cola and the like, most of which are caffeinated. And the lines crossed probably around 1973, which is the point at which we're consuming as much coffee as Coca-Cola. And then coffee continued to decline and Coke to or soft drinks to increase. We've seen some resurgence, you know, over the past 15 years due to the gourmet or specialty coffee boom. Coffee's definitely regained some market share, and we've even seen the growth of soft drink consumption level off and even decrease a little bit in the past few years. But soft drinks remain far and away the most popular beverage, you know, far more popular than coffee at this point, and it's reflected in the sales numbers. We spend about, maybe $35 billion annually on coffee in this country, and more than $70 billion annually on soft drinks. So, yeah, it's a surprise, but we are consuming less coffee per capita than we did, you know, say 50 or 60 years ago.
The history of coffee, as you give it here, too, is really interesting because apparently goats discovered it and humans discovered it from them.
That's the origin myth, and I think it's pretty interesting, too. The origin myth for coffee is that there was a goat herd named Kaladi on a hill in eastern Africa, and he's watching his goats, and they start nibbling on a red berry, and they become frisky. They start jumping around, and he, being an adventurous sort, figures, well, maybe I'll nibble on some of those berries myself, and he became frisky, and that's sort of the way that people think coffee was discovered, for its stimulant effect. And the other interesting thing about coffee, in terms of how coffee culture has evolved, is that in those days people were consuming it, you know, the whole berry, the whole coffee bean and the fruit, and mashing it up, you know, and eating it with maybe some animal fat or something else. And so it's really taken a long time for, you know, coffee to, it's been this gradual process over 1,500 years for coffee to have evolved from this raw fruit that people were eating to this you know, dried, roasted, ground, artfully prepared beverage that we enjoy today.
We sure have added a lot of steps to the process, that's for sure. In your coffee travels, and I noticed you ended up bringing up the term used generally by wine people, terroir. I mean, how different does coffee taste from one farm to the next? And you visited a bunch of them.
Yeah. Now, you know, I'm not an expert here, which is to say I don't have a very fine, refined palate. You know, I know what I like and I know what I don't like. But certainly it does vary dramatically, and it varies dramatically not just with how the plants are grown, what types of plants you're growing, and in what regions, you know, if you're growing on volcanic soils, et cetera. But it also varies with how the coffee is dried and processed. You know, in parts of Brazil, they do Brazilian naturals, so-called, so they're drying the bean and the fruit together. You know, in Central America, they have the washed beans. You know, they're slightly fermented and washed, and these are a lot of the fine coffees that we enjoy. So there is a tremendous range in the flavor of coffee and how it's grown. You know, in terms of, like, can you tell, you know, that this coffee is grown on this special soil that's, you know, 5 miles from some other farm? Maybe, but it's certainly not something I would be able to do.
We have another call here. Let's go to Al in Eugene, and welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mary Carpenter, the author of Caffeinated.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm wondering, like, there is a town in southern Yemen named Maha, and the Yemenis, and they're the one who actually took coffee and Islam to Indonesia, and I think it came back from there, too, as well. But the word Maha, And also in the word gahwa or qahwa in Arabic. In fact, in Central Arabia, where it was never colonized, there is a name of the house, part of the house named gahwa or qahwa. And you go to other places in the Arab world where they use the word maqha. So, my question is with regard to when coffee arrived to Europe.
Oh, that is a good question. Thanks for that.
That is an interesting question, and this is something that I'm not expert on, but there's a book that gets into it greatly called Uncommon Grounds by Mark Pendergrast. But you know, I think it was really it came up through the Arabian Peninsula and then into Italy and sort of migrated, as my understanding is, further west. Certainly by the 1700s, coffee culture was becoming well established, is my understanding, as far west as England.
From your research, did you get the sense that every place where coffee moved into a new region, that people went, this is bitter stuff, but after a while just kind of liked the effects and figured out ways to make it taste better?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the first part, about that we've figured that it's bitter at first. I do think it's an acquired taste. I think there's not that many people who taste their first cup of coffee and think, wow, this is what I've been waiting for all my life, you know. But one of the interesting things is that coffee, as it moves into a region, I think wherever people have been sort of exposed fully to coffee, it does seem to really take a foothold pretty quickly. And so, for example, when I was in China, you know, that's a traditionally a tea drinking culture. But now, in Beijing and all the big cities, you have not just coffee shops, you have Starbucks all over the place.
Wow, that is a big change. Now, you mentioned how we've been going to soft drinks, and there's some fun history of Coca-Cola in here. And what was Coca-Cola made of originally?
Yeah, so Coca-Cola originally had, in its earliest iteration, it had both coca, the coca leaf, and cola, the cola nut from Africa, which is a caffeinated nut. And I spend a whole chapter in the book looking at a trial. It was a journalist called it the famous Coca-Cola trial. It pitted the predecessor to the FDA, the Bureau of Chemistry, against Coca-Cola over the issue of added caffeine. And this was in 1909. By that point, Coca-Cola had moved to, blending pure powdered caffeine into their beverage. And they were getting that caffeine from Monsanto, which was just starting out as a chemical company in St. Louis. And the issues that came up at that trial were fascinating. It was, is caffeine different if it's blended into a product as a powder rather than as a natural constituent? Is Coca-Cola being marketed to children for whom it's unsafe? And is it an addictive chemical? And the thing that fascinated me about this this trial is that many of these questions are the same questions that we're asking today about energy drinks, and they've remained somewhat unresolved.
Which raises some questions about energy drinks. Jeannie in Medford dropped a question off a while ago about some of the contents. She mentions one phenol, I think, is what she's talking about. But I've noticed when I look at the labels when my kids have put them in front of me, it's like, what is taurine? Not that I really cared when I was drinking caffeine myself, but I mean, some of the stuff, the old rule, the fairly recent rule actually about don't consume anything if you can't pronounce the name of it. And there's a lot of stuff you can't pronounce the name of on the energy drinks.
There is so much you can't pronounce the name of. And this is one of the things that does interest the FDA is, the caffeine is one thing. And it's worth noting that while we consider energy drinks hyper-caffeinated, you would need to drink, say, four Red Bulls to equal the amount of caffeine that you would get in a grande at Starbucks. So they're not particularly super caffeinated. But the other ingredients are interesting. It's not clear that they have any particular stimulant effect, that they're, most of the stimulant effect you get from an energy drink, if not all, is going to be from the caffeine. But there is some question if perhaps some of these other ingredients, either alone or in synergy with caffeine, could cause health effects for people who are susceptible. So yeah, it's interesting, and I think that really those ingredients are there for just to pad the labels. So to take another example, 5-Hour Energy, they talk about amino acids and and vitamins. They sort of advertise all the elements in the energy shot that don't stimulate you, and they don't really say much about the caffeine.
Really? And so that, I mean, what's in there? Is it, I mean, I never had one. Does it have any particular flavor?
Yeah, I mean, they sort of taste like cough syrup. But really what, you know, 5-Hour Energy, the primary thing they have is, 180 to 200 milligrams of caffeine. So, you know, about as much as a small, strong cup of coffee.
You did spend some time talking to Bruce Goldberger, the toxicologist in here, and spent some time finding out about caffeine withdrawal. And so how real is that?
Caffeine withdrawal is real, and it can be pretty unpleasant. So not everyone will suffer from caffeine withdrawal, but most people, even if you take a small amount of caffeine daily, say, or, you know, moderate amount, 100 milligrams daily, so, you know, 3 cups of tea or, you know, certainly one cup of coffee or 3 cans of Coke, if you are at that level of caffeine consumption and you stop using caffeine abruptly, you will likely experience, you know, a predictable pattern of withdrawal. This might include headaches, lethargy, it's even flu-like symptoms with muscle pain. So it is real, and it's worth being aware of because, you know, if you are a regular caffeine user, you might experience these symptoms from time to time.
And do you still use yourself?
I do. I'm an avid coffee drinker.
All right. It's a lot of fun to read the book. A lot of great information in there as well. It's called Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. Mary Carpenter wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.